The following is the third part of a seminar entitled Ultimate Self-Realization, given by His Grace Sriman Sankarshan Das Adhikari, recorded on June 8th, 2008, in New Gokula, Australia.
So this session is called Ultimate Self-Realization 3. This self-realization, ultimate self-realization science is Krishna Bhakti. As we have described previously, there are three different stages of self-realization: impersonal Brahman realization, Paramatma realization, and Bhagavan realization. So the ultimate self-realization is Bhagavan realization. So who is a better teacher of the science of Bhagavan realization than Bhagavan himself? So we will hear from Sri Krishna Bhagavan today, reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita. Krishna will actually speak to us. It is not simply some dry book. Actually, Krishna will actually speak to us as we read his words. Just as potently as he spoke to Arjuna 5,000 years ago, he will speak to us just now as we read his words. If we dive deeply into the If we dive very, 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 very deeply into the hearing the message of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaking, then we can derive the same benefit that Arjuna derived 5,000 years ago. So first, for the sake of invoking auspiciousness, we will chant this mantra, and then we will chant the Bhagavad Gita mantra. So everyone can repeat after me with great devotion. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Gyanena tu tadagyanam yesham nashitam atmana tesham madhitya vajgyanam prakasha yati tatparam.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. When, however, one is enlightened with the knowledge by which nescience is destroyed, then his knowledge reveals everything, just as the sun lights up everything in the daytime. Purport. Those who have forgotten Krishna must certainly be bewildered. But those who are in Krishna consciousness are not bewildered at all. So this is a test. If you're ever feeling bewildered, that means you're not being Krishna conscious. That's why you're bewildered. It's an easy test we all can make. Am I feeling bewildered? That means I'm not Krishna conscious. Because one who is Krishna conscious, he cannot be bewildered. Prabhupada continues, it is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, sarvam jnana plavena jnanagni sarva karmani and nahi jnanena sadrusham. Knowledge is always highly esteemed. And what is that knowledge? Perfect knowledge is achieved when one surrenders unto Krishna. As it is said in the 7th chapter, 19th verse, Bahunam janmanamante jnanavanmang prapadyate. After passing through many, many births, when one perfect in knowledge surrenders unto Krishna, or when one attains Krishna consciousness, then everything is revealed to him as revealed with the sun in the daytime. The living entity is bewildered in so many ways. For instance, when he unceremoniously thinks himself God, like those yogis think that they're God, Katerina was telling me last night, she was studying the yoga class, and they were taught in the yoga class to think that they are God, you see. When he unceremoniously thinks he is himself God, he actually falls into the last snare of nescience. If a living entity is God, then how can he become bewildered by nescience? Does God become bewildered by nescience? If so, then nescience, or Satan, is greater than God. Real knowledge can be obtained from a person who is in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, one has to seek out a bona fide spiritual master. And under him, learn what Krishna consciousness is. For Krishna consciousness will certainly drive away all nescience as the sun drives away darkness. Even though a person may be in full knowledge that he is not this body, but is transcendental to the body, he still may not be able to discriminate between the soul and the supersoul. However, he can know everything well if he cares to take shelter of the perfect, bona fide, Krishna-conscious spiritual master. One can know God and one's relationship with God only when he meets a representative of God. A representative of God never claims that he is God, although he is paid all the respect ordinarily paid to God, because he has knowledge of God. One has to learn the distinction between God and a living entity. Lord Krishna therefore stated in the second chapter 2:12 that every living entity is individual in the past. If every living being is individual and the Lord is also individual, they were all individuals in the past, they are individuals at present, they will continue to be individuals in the future, even after liberation. At night, we see everything as one in the darkness. But in the day when the sun is up, we see everything in its real identity. Identity with individuality in spiritual life is real knowledge. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Jata Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupa Sagra Jata Sagana Raguna Tanvita Tam Sajiva Sadaita Savaduta Purijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakonvitamscha. An artificial sun won't do. We can try, you know, making some street light or some flashlight or a campfire to make some light in the night. But how much light we can actually make on our own arrangement? Can you light up the whole sky? Can you light up the whole universe with your artificial light? Is that possible? No. But when the sun comes and everything becomes illuminated, all the way from here to Sydney and down to Brisbane and up to Brisbane, down to Melbourne, I mean everywhere, out to Perth, all the way over to Fiji, The whole place becomes, can you imagine the power of the sun? It light up everything. Well, you'll do with your street light, you see, your car headlight. It's nothing compared to the sun. So with our mental speculation, we may try to bring some light in the darkness. Well, I think this, I think that, I think. But if we can connect with that powerful sun, Krishna, you see, he can illuminate everything. Everything becomes revealed when you see Krishna. When you understand what is God, then everything becomes clear. Just like in the dark, you can't even see your own hand. You can't see your watch unless you have one that glows in the dark. Mine glows in the dark for about an hour, and then after that you can't see it anymore. So you can't even see your own watch in the dark, you see. But if the sun is there, then everything is illuminated everywhere. So all we have to do is become Krishna conscious. That one simple thing, become Krishna conscious. And Prabhupada explains we have to seek out a bona fide spiritual master, you see, to learn what is Krishna consciousness. The knowledge is carefully handed down through disciplic succession. Evam parampara praptam mimrajashayo vidu. It's not some manufactured knowledge, you can make it up. You understand? We are an illusion. If we try to make up our own version of what is the absolute truth, it'll be an illusionary version. You see, a person in the darkness, he cannot manufacture the truth. Dharman tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. Actual religious principles are given by the Supreme Person. We cannot manufacture them. Any attempt that we make to manufacture religion is a failure. That's why all these manufactured religions going on now are a failure. Christianity, I mean, the original teachings were good, but nowadays they've completely polluted them. See. They've lost contact with actual religion. You know that word religion? It comes from the Latin religare. Religare means to reconnect. So religion simply means, if you're religious, it means you're connected with, you're reconnected with God. That's all. Formerly, we were connected with God, originally. But due to envy, we disconnected ourselves. We made a foolish mistake. We were envious of the Supreme Person. We disconnected ourselves from Him. But in the Bhagavad Gita, that Supreme Person is very kindly. And this is the one book where God Himself is speaking in detail. You see, the Bible, it's someone else is speaking. But here, God Himself is speaking directly, telling us exactly what to do to become reconnected with Him. Exactly, precisely. Satadam kirtayam tomam, always chant my glories. Patram pushpam palam tayam, offer your food to me, you see. In this way, yagyashishta shanashanto muchante sarvakil bishai. In this way, you become free of sin. By eating yagyashishta, the remnants of foodstuffs offered to me, just like now, everything you get here, that you eat here at this retreat, it's all yagyashishta. Prasad, you see, it is the remnants of sacrifice offered to Radha Gokulananda. Yagyashishta. So Krishna says, yagyashishta, it frees one from all pap. All pap you become free by taking yagyashishta. So if we will follow these guidelines given in the Bhagavad Gita by Krishna, then we will actually be religious. We will actually be reconnected with the Supreme Person. And when we have that connection, as Prabhupada explains here, when we have that Krishna consciousness, then we understand, everything is revealed to us. Everything becomes very crystal clear. We understand everything about reality, who I am, what is the ultimate truth, what is my relationship with the ultimate truth, how can I please that Supreme Person who is the ultimate truth, how can I escape the cycle of birth and death, how can I regain my original identity in the spiritual world. All of these things become clearly, clearly, clearly understood if we simply reconnect ourselves with that Supreme Person. And He tells us exactly how to do it. We don't have to guess. You see, man manava bad bhakto mujadji mang namaskaru mamajashi yukvai vang atmanang mad parayana. Engage your mind always in thinking of me. Offer obeisance and worship me, being completely absorbed in me, certainly you'll come to me. Now, doesn't that sound personal to you? How many times does Krishna say me? You see, man manava, engage your mind thinking of me. Offer obeisance and worship me, being completely absorbed in me, certainly you'll come to me. Four times me is appearing in that shloka. Four times. And the impersonalists say there is no me out there. It's just the Brahman. The impersonal Brahman speaking to us. How can an imperson speak to us? I mean, it's ridiculous. But here's somebody who's saying, me, 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 and they say there's no person? And God is not a person? Do impersons ever say me? You ever had a rock talk about itself? You see? Persons can be impersonal. We experience that all the time, especially in the corporate world. How many impersonal persons? There's many. Persons can be impersonal, that's a fact. But can impersons be personal? That's not possible. So the Mayavadis, they say that the ultimate truth is impersonal, but it's making a show of being personal in the Bhagavad Gita just to help us merge into the impersonal oneness. I mean, it's ridiculous. Because it's common sense. Persons can be impersonal, but impersons cannot be personal. So the Supreme Absolute Truth is actually a person, but he does have an impersonal aspect known as the impersonal Brahman. He can be impersonal, but it's not that that which is impersonal can be personal or make a show of being personal to attract us to merge into the impersonal. This is what the Mayavadis claim. Because you cannot think impersonal, therefore the impersonal Absolute is manifesting in the guise of personality to give you something to hold on to until you finally merge into impersonality. That's what they say. That's their philosophy, their teaching. But it's just not common sense. Because any child can understand that persons can be impersonal, but impersons cannot be personal. Therefore, the Absolute Truth, although it contains both impersonal and personal features, must basically are primarily be personal. It's common sense. So if you want to actually achieve the perfection of human existence, if you want to achieve the ultimate self-realization of perfect realization of the Absolute Truth, you must understand this distinction between personal and impersonal. Because especially in India, this impersonal philosophy is predominant. It's very prominent philosophy. That I'm God, you're God, we're all God. It's all just the impersonal oneness. You just have to merge back in, you see. The drop of water has to merge back into the ocean and just be the ocean again. But think about that, even that analogy. Don't hold your knees in front of the deities like that, yeah. And so, does the drop of water actually merge into the ocean and stay there forever? What happens to the water that goes into the ocean? Does it stay in the ocean? No, it evaporates into the sky and it comes to the land again. So this idea that you're just a drop of water, you got to merge into the ocean, and that is your perfection, that is not a very high-level understanding of perfection, because that's only a temporary position. The water in the ocean does not stay in the ocean. It comes back again to Australia. You see, and it comes down in the rain. And then gradually it goes back to the ocean again, and then it comes back to the land. What stays in the ocean, that's the fish. You see any sea fish falling from the sky here during the rain? No. The fish stay in the ocean. The water doesn't. So the Mayavadis, the impersonalists, they want to merge into that ocean, but they can only do so temporarily. But the Vaishnavas, they are like the fish. They stay in the ocean permanently, you see. Those who understand the personal feature of God, they surrender to Him with loving devotion, they remain in the ocean, the spiritual ocean, eternally. They never come again to the land. And this example I have given you is confirmed by the scriptures. Avruya krichchena parang pradam tada patantyuto nadrita dushmadangrayaha. Patanti and ho, they fall back again into this material existence. And their so-called liberation, it is vimukti. Vimukti means liberation, you see. Vimukti, or we say mukti, but vimukti makes it more emphatic. Vimukti, but what kind of vimukti it is? Vimukti maninas, in the mind only. They imagine they're liberated. They're not liberated, actually. They are not liberated, these Mayavadi impressionists. They think they're liberated. Yes, now I am God, you see. I realize that I am God. So then we ask them, well, all right, lift Govardhan Hill then. And then they're stumped. They can't do that, you see. If you're actually God, then lift the Govardhan Hill. We actually had that one young man, he came to our temple in Gainesville, and he said, I am God. So our temple president said, well, you know, when God was here 5,000 years ago, he lifted a mountain on his little pinky. But if you can lift our temple on your little pinky, we'll accept that you're God and we'll surrender to you. He couldn't do that. But then he said, well, we have a little Volkswagen Bug, you know, VW Bug, the old type, you know, the Beetle. Oh, they reintroduced him now, yeah. But he said, if you can just lift our Volkswagen Beetle on your little finger, we'll accept that you're God. And still he couldn't. And then he just said, just look into my eyes. And he thought that he could hypnotize us, you see, thinking that he was God. So, we don't accept such cheap incarnations of God. Nor do we think that we are God, you see. That by some yogic meditation that we can become God. If you're actually God, then why do you have to meditate to become God? If you are the Supreme Person, nothing can mess with your position. You're the Supreme Power. You can never lose your position. They say, I am God, but I'm simply covered by Maya. That means that's illogical. That means Maya is more powerful than God. Is that a logical thing? That Maya can be more powerful than the Supreme? No. The illusory energy, Maya, is an inferior energy of the Lord. What kind of God is that Maya or illusion can become more powerful than Him? You see, we do not accept such false conceptions. If you're actually God, then nothing can ever take away your position as the Supreme. You can never be usurped by any power. Therefore, that we are presently caught up within karma chakra, we are in the dungeon of God's existence right now, this material world. So it's obvious we're not God. Any intelligent, sane person can immediately understand, I am not God. So, as Prabhupada says, this is very unceremonious. He's very nicely, poetically stated by Prabhupada. He is used in his purport, this term. Where does he say that? The unceremoniously thinking himself to be God. Yeah. Where does he say this? Yeah, for instance, when he unceremoniously thinks himself God, he actually falls into the last snare of nescience. So what does that mean, unceremoniously? If something is done ceremoniously, it's done with very nice style, you see. Something is ceremoniously done. It's done very nicely. First class, you see. First class way, you see. But unceremonious means he's like a bumbling idiot. Can't even walk through the door without tripping on his, you know, on his pants that are hanging too low, you know. Like nowadays they wear the pants real low. He can't even get through the door without tripping on his own pants. That's called unceremonious, you see. So here, Prabhupada is using this word for these people who consider they are God. They are unceremonious. You see, they're like some bumbling kid whose pants are halfway down. He falls over, tripping on his own pants. So this is what the Mayavadis are like. Unceremoniously thinking they are the Supreme One. So in this way, we need to understand this wonderful science of bhakti. The first thing to understand, you are not God. That's the first thing. To understand that you are not the Supreme Person. You are part and parcel of the Supreme Person. And what does that mean? You see, if you are part of something, what does it mean? Just like I have this nice MP3 recorder here. I record all my lectures and they get posted on the internet and people all over the world can hear them. But every part of this nice gadget here, this MP3 recorder, serves the function of the entire unit, you see. Every part of it is designed to serve the complete whole unit. So that is true of things manufactured by man. Also, you take the tree, for example. That's manufactured by God. Also, in the tree, each part of the tree is meant to serve the complete unit of the tree. So we can see in things manufactured by God and things manufactured by man that the part is always meant to serve the whole. So we can understand that we are not the complete whole. When you eat, do you feed everybody? I know you're not, because I saw you eating the other day and I didn't satisfy my appetite. So, we are not the complete whole. We are, each and every one of us, we are part of the complete whole. So what does that mean? By simple logic, we can understand, since I am part of the complete whole, I'm meant to serve that complete whole. And that complete whole is revealed as the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the Sri Ishapanishad. Om Purnam Madaha Purnamidam Purnat Purnam Udachyate Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnam Eva Vashishyate. So we are part of that complete whole Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, we are naturally, scientifically meant to serve that Supreme Person. And as soon as you do that, then you immediately become satisfied. That's the beauty of serving the complete whole personality of Godhead. As soon as you serve Him, you immediately become satisfied. When you give the food to your belly, then all the parts of your body become nourished. If the hand foolishly thinks, why am I feeding the stomach? Let me just take the food separately. It takes the rice and the dal and it tries to squeeze it. Let me get some nutrition. Will it be successful? No. There's a nice story in this connection. I may have told you previously, last year in Govinda Valley. I do not remember. But the parts of the body, they became very disturbed. They were doing all this work for that stomach. It just sits there and enjoys the fruit of our hard labor. They became very disturbed. They decided to form a labor union. And they went on strike. Don't feed the stomach. They had their signs. They were marching back and forth. A big, big, loud demonstration. Don't feed the stomach. The stomach is a fascist pig. Don't feed the stomach. You see, protesting this lazy capitalist pig. You see, just sitting there taking the fruit of all their hard labor. So, with great enthusiasm, they were going on with their demonstration the first day. The second day, they started to lose a little energy. But the third day, they couldn't even get up. You know, they're just lying there. And finally, they said, with their last little energy, they said, you know, I think we should call another meeting of the labor union. So, they said, we have to cancel this strike. I don't know what's going on here, but we're losing all of our energy. So, if you serve that complete whole Supreme Personality of God, as we studied in this morning's Bhagavatam class, if you simply serve the material nature, you will just lose all your energy. You become an old senior citizen with no energy left to even go on a fired-up vacation eventually, you see. They say now you can retire. There's nothing left to enjoy with anymore. Your senses are totally worn out. But if you employ that energy in the service of Krishna, then you get more energy, more energy, more energy, more energy. And even in your final days, you'll have the energy of a young person. You see? People can't believe I'm 60 years old. You see? They think, no, you couldn't be 60 years old. And the fact is, I still feel like I'm a 22-year-old brahmacharya that joined ISKCON in 1971. except for a hearing problem, but, you know, those things are there. But because we rise beyond the bodily conception, we, even if the body is going through some, you know, it does, the body goes through the aging process, but the energy doesn't come from the body, the energy comes from Krishna. If you connect with that supreme energy source, then you have unlimited energy at your disposal. Krishna can give you however much energy you can use in his service, that's how much energy he'll give you. So the more you engage in Krishna's service, the more you become energized. That's why do you think I travel in Vishnupriya Mataji and I, who's seated here, or those of you who don't know her, she's seated right here. Why do we travel all over the world? Practically, you know, the majority of the time we're on the road, traveling around the world, preaching Krishna consciousness. We hardly even forget what our house even looks like sometimes. It's been so long since we've been there. Of course, we have some disciples there just writing us, when will you come back, when will you come back? And they want us, just like you all want us to come, they all want us to come visit them from time to time. People are amazed. Don't you get tired from all this constant traveling around the world? But the thing is, by engaging this energy in the service of Krishna, we get more energy and more energy and more energy and more energy. I become enlivened to plan. I've already booked the tickets for the, I've already booked my dates for December when I'm going to, Govinda Valley has already said we can come there unless some yogis come with some big money. They're going to give us Govinda Valley for the next retreat, the weekend before Christmas. I've already booked that. I've already bought the tickets. And now I'm planning next, a year from now, I'm working on, be planning that when we get back to the U.S. in July. I'll be planning the spring tour of 2009. So, in this way, we're very, very energized to keep traveling and spreading this knowledge. The goal is to revolutionize the planet. We want to make so much enthusiasm about Krishna consciousness that the leaders finally wake up and they say, what's going on here? These Hare Krishna people, they have something that we don't have. We need to listen to them. We need to let these people tell us how to run Australia and America and Russia and Britain, France and Germany and Estonia, Lithuania. We need to start listening to these Hare Krishna people because they have something that we don't have. They have some knowledge. They have some happiness. They have some love beyond anything that we have in the material existence. You see? So we want to create an energy now in this Hare Krishna movement that will attract the entire world to want to take guidance from us. Even if they don't want to join us full on, at least they should take our principles and apply it to their Christian practice, their Muslim practice, their Buddhist practice, their Jewish practice, etc. You see, they should learn from us how to be better Christians, how to be perfect Christians, perfect Jews, perfect Muslims, and perfect Buddhists. You see, that kind of an atmosphere we want to create on this planet. That they will see that this Hare Krishna movement, they are the lead, this, they have the, they are the most highly educated, learned, and the most pious people on this planet. We want to create this kind of an atmosphere where everyone will come to Hare Krishna movement for inspiration, for guidance, and for blessings, how to become happy and perfect in their human form of life. This is our goal. This is why we're traveling. We're trying to plant this seed everywhere through the ISKCON world, that everyone will come to ISKCON. So I can ask now, we have some time for questions. Be happy to try to answer any questions that may come. Yeah.
I just wanted to know that chapter 9, text 33, can you explain that verse? Because I was not able to understand what you were talking about.
I'm going to give a lecture on another verse now.
No, just that particular text, I couldn't understand what that is.
This is 5:16.
Okay. I just
you can look it up.
Yeah,
if you want me to discuss another verse, that's a whole other lecture.
I just wanted to know if you can explain, because I couldn't understand even by reading that. So
9 what?
5:16. No, chapter 9, text 33.
No, that's not the sort of question I'm looking for. I mean, you're asking me to basically give another class on a different verse now. Now, that That why don't you read Prabhupada's purport first then? Now, specific questions we can take, but not saying, Guru Maharaj, can you please explain, Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter number 2, text number 35. Now, that's a whole other lecture.
That's fine. I just wanted to know that if you can explain, I couldn't understand by reading it. So I thought probably I'd take
But as far as, to give a question like that is not, that's not the appropriate kind of question. No. There's to be a specific question, a specific point. Can you explain this verse? Of course I can. All right, there's the answer. Of course I can explain any verse of Bhagavatam. Okay, that's the answer. I can do it, yes. Any other questions? I hope you understand my point. It means a whole other lecture.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, this time is meant for specific questions on specific, specific questions about philosophical points or like that. Yeah.
I'm just interested. What's the difference between people which are obviously, when they say they're God, there's so many people, for example, in psychiatric hospitals which say they're God, or which they say they're like some Napoleon or Hitler or Jesus Christ, basically all of them say this. But this impersonal Brahman realization, what's the difference? What's the main point where somehow... Like the folk
Maharas,
for example, they were Brahman realized and they
realized. Yes, there's two different things here. Brahmavadi, and there's a subtle distinction between Brahmavadi and Mayavadi. A Brahmavadi means someone who has advanced to the point of impersonal Brahman, thinking that to be the supreme truth. They've advanced that far. The Brahmavadi, but a Brahmavadi, he's not against the idea of the personality of Godhead. It simply has not been introduced to him, that's all. And if he hears about it from a pure devotee, he will accept it and he'll become a Vaishnava. A Bhagavan Vadi, you see. But the Mayavadi, that means he's heard about the personal conception, but he's decided he has an agenda against it. He wants to kill that conception. He's envious of that conception. They both, the Brahmavadi and the Mayavadi, both accept impersonal Brahman, but the difference is the Brahmavadi, like the Kumaras, they were open, they were pure. They'd simply advanced to that stage. As soon as they got an opportunity to go higher, they took it immediately. But the Mayavadi, even you offer him the opportunity, he will be very agitated and disturbed. He's inimical to the conception of God's personality. That's the difference. Yeah, it's a demoniac mentality, that's right. Envious. He's antagonistic against the personality of Godhead. Yes?
There's an ongoing dispute about different types of food, whether it's okay or not. Like, some devotees think it's all right to eat, like grains, bread, say bread made by non-devotees, as long as they're vegetarian. Others say no, we shouldn't eat kami grains. There's things like ice cream, sour cream, different things like this. What can you say about eating food?
The best thing is to be as pure as possible, according to time, place, and circumstance. The purer you are, the better. The highest standard is to take the raw ingredients and make everything yourself from scratch. It's like for Sri Sri Radhadamana, we never buy them ice cream from the marketplace. We make sometimes from scratch. Very nice ice cream, mango ice cream, or raspberry ice cream, or blueberry ice cream. From scratch we make it for them. That's the proper standard. I see many devotees, they'll have like Kellogg's cornflakes sitting in their kitchen. That's not good for the consciousness to eat grains cooked by non-devotees. What you can do... There's fantastic recipes for granola. You can easily make your... You buy the raw oats and you can have different ingredients. You can go on the internet and get so many wonderful recipes for granola because it's a convenient thing. You just pour the... You pour the... just pour the cereal in the bowl, put some milk, and you eat it, and you're out the door on the way to work. It's fast, it's easy, and it's nutritious. But you can do the same thing by making your own granola. Like once every couple of weeks, you can make a huge batch of granola, put it inside an airtight container to keep it fresh. And then you got your granola, which is 10 times more delicious than the Kellogg's cornflakes. And it's made by a devotee offered to Krishna. So it's not that it's some austerity to give up your Kellogg's cornflakes. You're getting something 10 times more delicious and more nutritious. And it's surcharged with bhakti because you made it for Krishna. So it's just a lot of times devotees just don't realize that, you know, the eating, you know, karmi-made cereals is like lighting a fire and putting water on it at the same time. You're chanting Hare Krishna and then you chant your 16 rounds and then you eat some karmi-made cereal. It's like putting water on the fire of bhakti. But if you, after your 16 rounds, you have a breakfast of granola that was offered to Krishna, that you made for Krishna, then your Krishna consciousness becomes even more powerful. So especially karmi-made grains are the worst thing. So, of course, under emergency, if you're traveling, but my wife and I never eat food on the airplane. We always make arrangements somehow to carry our own food with us. They can offer us, you know, they can offer so many things. They're amazed. They offer us this thing, that, and we say, no, no, no. We pull out our brown bag, you know, and say, give us the, you know, maybe we'll take the salt and pepper, you know. Prabhupada wouldn't even take the salt from the airline. He was that strict. He wouldn't even take the salt at the airline. He brought everything, and Prabhupada brought all of his servants would bring his own lunch. He always brought his own. He never ate anything from the airline. We bring our own salt. Yeah, that's right. That's right. All around the world, she carries her own salt. Actually, strict Hindus, they won't even take the water on the airplane. I've heard strict Hindus, they won't even take the water on the airplane. They only take it home, you see. They won't eat on the airplane. So, yeah, the more you can avoid this stuff, the better off you are. The more you can make everything from scratch, the better off you are. You know, it's not that difficult to make things yourself, and it's much more satisfying, and it's much more delicious, and it's much more devotional. You know, why should you buy some cupcake when you can make your own? It's not that difficult. There's so many cookbooks. Just leave out the eggs. Put some yogurt in instead of the eggs, you know. Yeah, the stricter you are, the faster you advance in Krishna consciousness. And you'll be more healthy, more happy, and you'll be getting better tasting food also. Much better tasting than this karmi-made stuff.
Chocolate is also intoxicating.
Hmm?
Chocolate? That's an intoxication, isn't it?
Yeah, in the Vedabase, Prabhupada clearly says we should not take chocolates. One godbrother told me that the Prabhupada told him it was okay to take chocolate. But Prabhupada also said it's better not to take advantage of concessions. So we at our home base, we don't use any chocolate at all. We use carob, which is a nice carob is acceptable. You can put a lot of carob in something and make a very carob rich thing, and it's practically like chocolate. Almost you can hardly tell the difference. Yeah, chocolate is not necessary. We can be healthy and happy without chocolate, and carob will give you almost put a lot of carob in, and it's practically the same thing. Milk?
Yeah. Dairy,
yes, milk is very Krishna conscious.
Yeah,
Krishna loves the milk products. Don't you know? He's called butter thief. Krishna is very much like the dairy products, yes.
Yeah, but the dairy industry is such that, you know, they do this cruelty to animals.
Get your own cow then. You get a piece of land, get a cow. You see, I have a disciple in Bulgaria. He has his own. He doesn't have a big farm. He just has a backyard. He keeps a cow, and then he brings the milk from the cow, and he has a hand churn. He churns the butter. Oh, the most wonderful butter you'd ever imagine. You see, My disciple Narada Muni Das in Bulgaria, he brings me the butter from this cow. Oh, that's real eating. Actually, Prabhupada accepted that milk from these poor cattle, the slaughterhouse cows. That's a kindness upon those cows. Because they're going through hell, but if we can offer their milk to Krishna, then they get blessing. That their milk was offered directly to the Lord. That cow, even though he's in the hands of the demons who will slaughter him or her, by offering her milk to Krishna, then she gets blessing. She'll come to the human form that much quicker, you see, because her milk was offered to Krishna. So that is a kindness, actually, to use these poor animals' milk and butter in the service of Krishna. And Prabhupada did it. This is a big argument we have with vegans. You know, they're always saying, you Hare Krishna people are okay, but at this point you're really wrong because you're supporting the slaughterhouses by taking their milk. But the thing is, they don't realize the importance of milk. For developing finer brain tissues, milk is required. Actually, one should drink hot milk in the evening. Hot milk. You take the hot milk, it's very digestible. Of course, it's a little bit, by homogenizing it, they've made it hard to digest, actually. But the best you can do is to heat it up and drink, sipping it hot. Prabhupada would take hot milk in the evening, sipping hot milk. Not you just drink it. It's so hot you have to sip it, little bit, little bit, little bit. Hot, sipping hot milk. Prabhupada introduced, this was the old standard in the early days, and we were all living in the ashrams. We would take every night hot milk and Krishna book, you see. That was the program every evening for all the devotees. We'd all sit down in the Vishadam room, somebody would read the Krishna book, and we would sip on the hot milk, you see. So Prabhupada knew where the milk was coming from, but yet he encouraged us to drink the milk because we need that for developing the brain tissue to understand higher knowledge. And it is blessing the cows also, that they can advance quickly to the human form by their milk being offered to the deities. Anybody else over here? I'm getting all... Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to add to that, that you can... Most supermarkets these days, you can buy unhomogenized milk.
In Australia, but not in the U.S. I wish we could do it in the U.S. Yeah. In California, yes. In Australia, yes. But in Texas, no. I've been in Texas. We're just stuck. They won't. The law. You're lucky in Australia. The whole country. Huh? That's great. Yeah, I recommend the unhomogenized milk because it's more digestible. Boil it though. Of course, it's boiled. I'm sure they boil it to purify it. Now, don't take unboiled milk right out of the cows. I went to New Govardhan, and one of the cowherd boys there. He was real gung ho. He just came and said, here, drink this. It was right out of the cow, hadn't been boiled or anything. I got diarrhea immediately. So you need to boil it first. Even if you take it out of the cow, you need to boil the milk first. That's a Vedic standard, boiling the milk. Mother Jasoda was boiling the milk. The milk boiled over when she got Damodar angry at her, actually. So yeah, the boiling the milk is a Vedic standard, not just raw milk out of the cow. It must be boiled first. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
I can appreciate what you're saying about the cows getting blessings, you know, but if all of us are thinking, well, the cows get the blessings, so let's not worry about it, then doesn't it make us lazy? Like, we've got 600 acres here. If more devotees would help, we could have a proper dairy here and at least produce some milk. But because we've all decided it's okay...
I agree with you 100%. So, devotees, there should be energy put back into this project that we can have a dairy farm here, and that milk can be distributed to everyone. Everybody can get the milk. There can be a system for sending the milk to Sydney on a regular basis, and devotees can come to the temple and the whole thing can be organized. Everybody can get milk from the farm. That'd be wonderful. I think that should be done. I think you all should do that. You should make an arrangement here to have a milk and profuse supply of milk here, so much so that you have to ship it to Sydney, and that you all can share the milk there. I wholeheartedly recommend that. You should do that. Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Jai. Yeah. That what? God is... They say what?
Guys.
Oh, guys. I had to correct one of my disciples the other day. He said, guys, talking about me.
Huh? When they are daily basis addressing one another like that, so it becomes a habit, and then when senior devotee comes, then also that happens.
Yeah, this karma lingo is... Some of it is really unconducive for Vaishnava culture. We have to understand that, you know, these are worshipable. Vaishnava is a worshipable personality. Sadhu sanga, sadhu sanga, sarva satre gai, lava matra sadhu sanga, sarva siddhi hai. A Vaishnava, even one moment's association with a sadhu, a saintly devotee of the Lord, can bestow all perfection. So to just casually talk about how you guys doing or things like that, it's not very good. And they made it the Vedic culture has gender distinctions also for protection from illicit sex. And now guys used to be a word for males, and it was guys and gals in the old days, you see. But now they've made guys a generic term for everybody. This sort of blind, you know, gender blindness, blurring the distinction between males and females, is dangerous because it opens the door for illicit sex connection also. So to respectfully call devotees according, you know, with the gender distinction instead of merging it all into one, that is more proper. So that's another problem I have with guys, you see. It's very casual, it's just like karmis. It's not offering respect that here's a devotee of the Lord. And then it also cuts out the gender distinction also, which is a dangerous thing. So I personally don't like this devotees using the word guys. The first time I heard it was in Southern California, which is very typical. That's where everything weird comes from, Southern California. But I don't... Someone may say I'm an old-fashioned fanatic for saying these things, but I don't think so. I think it's not. I think it's countercultural. It goes against our Vedic culture. That sort of terms. That's my strong opinion.
What can you say about some devotees? More and more these days, devotees going to different groups like Satchananda in Australia. We have Satchananda. It's an impersonal, so-called spiritual group, and they teach yoga, hatha yoga, and there's ISKCON devotees going to learn yoga there. Do you think that's not good because they get subtle contamination from that?
Before I joined this movement, I went to hear that Swami Satchidananda, and he said, I'm God, you're God, and we're all God. That was his teaching. So if we go to associate, actually one of my disciples, she was going to some groups and taking hatha yoga. And then she wrote me saying, I mean, I'm having trouble with my Krishna consciousness. Do you think it's because I'm going to these hatha yoga classes? I said, yes. I said, if you want to do hatha yoga, do it on your own. You don't need to go do it with these people, you know. So, yeah, it's associated. If you want to go and give a lecture to them, in fact, when I was traveling with Vishnu John Swami, we stayed at a Satchidananda ashram in New York, and they had us do a whole program, prasadam, kirtan. We took over the ashram for 2 or 3 days. It was great. Had all these yogis chanting and dancing and taking prasad in total bliss. That way is very good. You can go there and become the leaders in their ashram. But to go there as a student, oh, that's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. If you want to learn some asanas, get one of their books, you know. You need to learn, or devotees can teach you the asana. Now, there's so many devotees who know hatha yoga. You learn from hatha yoga from some devotees. Hatha yoga is healthy. Prabhupada recommends it. You can cure all disease by hatha yoga. We're not against hatha yoga, although we're not going to turn this into a hatha yoga movement. You know, that after Mangal Arati, we'll all do asanas. You know. We'll have it part of the morning program. We're not going to do that. But if devotees individually want to do some asana for it helps their brahmachari or whatever. That's all right. Huh? I see. Yeah, well, I don't think Prabhupada would like them to be, make it part of the standard morning program. Devotees want to do it individually. That's all right. I would never allow it in my, if my disciples wanted to, if they're my disciples, I would tell them no. But they're not, so. But Prabhupada never instituted them. But it is good. If devotees on their own want to do it in their own time, it's good, it's healthy. There's no doubt it's good for them. Prabhupada confirms it in his books. But to institute it as part of our, you know, our sadhana, that's not very good. Not very good. It's a very bad precedent, not good. Yeah. You want to benefit the corn? The people who work at the corn factory? A cow is innocent. It is not sinful.
So it's a farmer making the corn.
Now the cow itself, the farmer doesn't give the milk, okay? From his breast. The cow is an innocent creature. She's giving the milk from her breast. The farmer does not manufacture the milk. The cow is manufacturing the milk. The cow is an innocent animal. The people who work in Kellogg's corn factory, they're not innocent people. They're engaged in all kinds of pap. They're different. Understand? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's another matter. Thing is, according to Ayurveda, we require milk for finer brain tissues. So we have to get them. So we should have our own milk. That's a fact. As Krishna Rupa Manaji pointed out, we need to have our own milk. But if we don't have it yet, in the meantime, we can utilize the. Better we get our own farms, that's a fin. It's better we have our own farms and have our own milk, that's a fin. Any other questions? Yes.
If it's not an appropriate question, please don't answer this. But I'm very curious about the role of the representative of God that you talked about, role of the mediator. And It definitely is a trend or a tradition with the monotheistic faiths where they definitely have someone who represents God to show them the path. But from what little I know of Hinduism, being a Hindu myself, I've always found that there is an element of personal love and devotion in Hinduism. Like the whole idea of the bhakti movement started with rejecting old traditions of rituals and actually arguing for a personal understanding of religion, personal realization. So I was very curious if you could dwell a little bit more on what the role of the mediator is, how we should seek this mediator, and how this mediator comes to realize God, can show the way to others.
That's a very good question. I appreciate that question. Why do we need a mediator? Why can't we just directly go to God? That is a question that many people have. So, let's say we go ahead and do that. We go directly to God. Right? Let's say we do that. We decide, I don't want a mediator. I just want to have my own personal relationship with God. So I will go directly to God. You see, I will simply approach, God is directly revealed Himself in Bhagavad Gita. Why do I need a mediator? This is the argument that I had on the same point that you're breaking. I made the same point. I moved into the ashram not as to become a disciple, but just to check out the ashram and see what it was like to live in an ashram. I told the Swami, Swami Vishnujan, I'm just moving into the ashram to check it out. And he said, that's fine. So my attitude is, well, I don't need a mediator. I just have my own relationship with Krishna. I was thinking like that. But then once I got in the ashram, the devotee said, but look here in chapter 4, text number 34. Tadvidhi pranipatena padiprasnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tattvadarshinah. Just try to learn that Krishna, this is the order of Krishna. If I'm saying I want to be a disciple of Krishna, I don't need a mediator. I just want to do whatever Krishna says. Krishna says, just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized souls can impart knowledge unto you because they have seen the truth. So when the devotees showed me that, I knew that I couldn't say anything. Because if I'm saying I want to be a devotee of Krishna, but I don't want to be a disciple of the Guru, then I'm disobeying Krishna. Krishna is ordering me that I should become a disciple of the Guru. So, if I want to have that relationship of being surrendered to Krishna, then you have to, it's like a package deal. You see what I'm saying? It's part of the deal. If you want to be a devotee of Krishna, you have to have a spiritual master. That's Krishna's instruction. You can't say, well, Krishna, I don't like the way you packaged Krishna Bhakti. Please package it a different way for me. It doesn't work that way. Krishna has already packaged this system. In fact, the system that he teaches in the Bhagavad Gita, it was also formally being taught. Krishna tells Arjuna, sa evayang mayate ja yoga prakta paratanam. He says, that very ancient science of the relation, that very ancient science, 5,000 years ago, Krishna said that what I'm teaching you is an ancient science. So Krishna has not given anything different than what was practiced for thousands of years, even before he spoke the Bhagavad Gita. So if we say, I want to be a devotee of Krishna, then are we going to manufacture our own Krishna that doesn't require me to have a spiritual master? Or I'm going to take the real Krishna who spoke to Arjuna and follow what he said? You see what I'm saying? So if I really want to follow Krishna, then I have to have a spiritual master because he's directly ordered here in the Bhagavad Gita and it's confirmed elsewhere also. Mundaka Upanishad confirms, tadviganartam sagrumeva bhikaschap. Do you know a little Sanskrit grammar?
No.
In Sanskrit grammar, the verbal ending changes the meaning. Like gachati, he goes. Gachanti, they go. You see, it's the same gach. But the ending changes the meaning. So in the Vidhi Lin form of the verb, gachchet, that means must go. You see. So he must go outside. So anyway, tadvaganartam sagarum eva bhikatschet, that means you must go to the spiritual master to realize the absolute truth. Confirmed in Mundaka Upanishad. And if that's not enough evidence, we've heard from the Bhagavad Gita, we've heard from the Mundaka Upanishad, then let's look in the Bhagavatam itself. Tasmad gurum prapadyecha yagyashu shreya uttamam. If you want to realize that ultimate benefit, shreya uttamam, then you must go to the spiritual master and take shelter of him by initiation. That's confirmed in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam. So, the point is, if I actually want to be a religious person according to the Vedic system, even in Christianity they require a guru. Jesus is the guru, you see. They say you cannot approach God directly, but only through Jesus. Jesus is the guru. So the concept of guru is a universal principle. It's even in Christianity. So, if we want to manufacture our own religion that doesn't require a guru, that means we're trying to make ourselves the guru. That's all we're trying to do. But the Bhagavatam says that you cannot manufacture your own religion. Dharman hi sakshat bhagavat pranitam. Religion can only be given by God. So God is saying you must have a spiritual master. Now, nowadays we're leery of spiritual masters. Why? Because there's so many charlatans out there just after our money, right? Or having illicit sex with their female disciples. I mean, it's pretty gross, you know, what's going on in these ashrams nowadays. So-called gurus. They're just cheaters. Even one famous guru in South India, he was having sex with little boys. This yogi who pulls the ashes, you know, ashes out of his foot, he was having sex with little boys. And they were saying that he was Bhagavan. Some mother from America, she reported that he was having sex with her son. You see, so-called big guru. I don't want to mention his name here. But. So we are very hesitant now to have gurus because we see that they're cheaters. But what is it when there's a cheater? What does it mean? A couple of years ago, I was leaving India. I was flying out of Bombay or Mumbai up to Kuala Lumpur. So what I always do when I leave India is I cash in my rupees for U.S. dollars. So I, you know, they have some value when I get back to my home base in the U.S. So I gave them a few 500 rupee notes. And they took all of them and gave me the U.S. dollars, but they gave me one back. And they said, this is counterfeit. Of course, I was disappointed. Somebody cheated me. They gave me a counterfeit 500 rupee note. I mean, if it had been a 1 rupee note, it wouldn't have been so bad. But a 500 rupee note, that has a little value. I wasn't very happy. So now I'm not going to go back to India because I got cheated with a 500 rupee note. Now I'll say no more will I ever deal with rupees ever again because I was given a counterfeit rupee. No. I just had to be careful. That's all. So there are some counterfeit so-called gurus out there who are cheating, who are after money, who are after women, who are after little boys or whatever. You know, there are cheaters out there. That's a fact. But does that mean they're all cheaters? No. Counterfeit note means somewhere there's a genuine note. Otherwise, there cannot be a counterfeit note. You understand? So if there are gurus that are not really qualified to be guru, that indicates that they are simply a cheap, cheating imitation of the real principle of guru. So the guru principle is in every field. Are you educated? Did you go to the university?
Yes, I'm doing my PhD.
You're doing a PhD. Do you have any mentors?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Why? If I don't need guru, then why do I have a mentor to get my PhD? You understand? In every field, if I want knowledge, I go to a person who has that knowledge. And they mentor me and help me along the pathway. In your own field, you're already having guru in your academic study. So in every field of knowledge, if I want to become expert, I require a mentor, a teacher, a guru to guide me. What field are you getting your PhD in? International communications?
Relations.
Oh, very good. So yes, if I want to become expert in international relations, I find someone who's extremely expert and I study under that person. I get the benefit of their knowledge, their realization, their experience, isn't it? So if that's true in international relations, it's also true in inter-universal relations. Between me and God. You see? So it's the same principle. We just apply it. You're doing an international. We're doing an inter-universal. It's the same principle. We're just taking it a step higher. That's all. To a larger scope. We're going beyond the universe. But the same principle of having a mentor is there. It's confirmed by Krishna. We just have to make sure it's not a cheater. And how will you know? If we take the second half of the verse from the Mundaka Upanishad that I quoted, then we will know the difference between a cheater and a real thing. You certainly wouldn't go for a PhD in one of these quack universities, would you? It's not accredited. Why waste your money and your time, right? You're going to an accredited university, right? That's recognized by all the academic world. So we need a guru who's recognized by all the genuine sadhus, not some quack upstart who's claiming that I'm God and I can make you God in 6 months if you just stand on your head and give me $1,000, you see. So one has to find the bona fide spiritual master. So the second half of the verse, tadviganatamasam, samit panihi shrotiyam brahmanishtam. The Mandaka Upanishad clearly tells us what we need. We need a spiritual master. Shrotiyam means he is fixed, he is learned, he is fixed in the Vedic with Shruti, you see. Vedic wisdom is Shruti. So he is fixed in Shruti, and he is solidly fixed in Vedic wisdom. And the second half, Brahma Nishtam, he is fixed up in Krishna consciousness, in knowledge of the Brahman, the supreme spiritual truth. He is fixed in them, you see. So we find a highly learned spiritual master who knows the Vedic wisdom inside and out, upside down. He knows the Vedic wisdom inside and out. He really knows and understands the Vedic wisdom. And he's a living embodiment of the Vedic wisdom. He's not just simply a dry academic professor, but he lives and breathes the Vedic wisdom with his every breath, 24 hours a day. If we can find such a teacher, as I found in my teacher, His Divine Grace, Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa, Pariva Jakacharja, Astatarasada Shishi Mad Esi Bhakti Vedantati Dandi Goswami Maharaj Prabhupada. If we can find such a teacher on this planet, then we should become his student. In that way, we will become highly learned and realize ourselves, just as you're doing in your academic study, the same exact principle. Would you try to become expert without... You have not done. You have taken the advice and the help and the mentorship of highly expert persons in that field. So if you're doing it for this thing, why not do it for the highest truth? You see, that's the point. So you understand?
Yeah.
That's an excellent question. It wasn't dumb. It was one of the best questions I've ever been asked. So please continue asking such nice questions in the future. I'm very happy you asked such a nice question. Okay, any other questions? Oh, and by the way, I have a facility. If you want to ask more questions when the retreat is over, here, take my card.
Thank you.
Okay, next question. Competing with that one now. Okay, go ahead.
Just following on that point, someone may recognize they need a guru and they can't go directly to God, but what do we say to the people who just think, well, we'll go to Prabhupada and Prabhupada will be guru?
Yes, Prabhupada can certainly be your guru. And Prabhupada is a siksha guru for the whole universe for at least the next 10,000 years. Prabhupada is the guru of all of us, there's no doubt. So, what does guru mean? It means you obey his instructions, right? So Prabhupada is clearly instructed that we should take diksha. And he has clearly told us in Vrindavan that after his absence from this world, the new people who come to our movement would take diksha from his disciples. He clearly said they will be the disciples of my disciples. So, if taking Prabhupada as your guru means you obey his instruction. So that means you want to really be a true follower, disciple of Prabhupada, then you take diksha from one of his disciples. It's simple, 1 + 1 = 2. Some people try to make it complicated. They say, no, 1 + 1 = 3. But it's actually 1 + 1 = 2. We accept that everybody can be a disciple of Prabhupada, there's no doubt. Now do what he said. If you're a disciple, that Prabhupada personally instructed me. Disciple means discipline. It means you obey the order of the spiritual master. Not that you invent your own program and say, I'm a Prabhupada disciple. We're all Prabhupada disciples, but there's different types of Prabhupada disciples. There's disciples, there's disciple disciples, grand disciples, great grand disciples, great 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 grand disciples, great 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 grand disciples. We're all disciples of Prabhupada. This is the Prabhupada Sampradaya. This is the Brahma, Madhva, Gaudiya, Prabhupada, Sampradaya. You see, we're all Prabhupada disciples here. But we connect through the system that Prabhupada gave us, that after his departure, we become the disciples of his disciples. You see, that's what it means to be a follower of Prabhupada. You accept his instruction. Not that you invent your own so-called Ritvic philosophy, not you, but, people. Your own so-called Ritvic philosophy, you see.
like, you know, coming across what they're saying. And so they, you know, so they'll take the one letter, they'll take the July 9th letter, and they'll take that as a fact. And then they'll say, in the conversation you're talking about, it's just some old tapes. They say, oh, it's just some old tapes. And it's like, they sort of say in Prabhupada, that whatever he said in that conversation, they just sort of, they try and discard it, saying, oh, that's just some old tapes.
Oh, they say it's just some small tape. It's not very... Yeah, I mean, they're just jug. They have an agenda. Anybody who's open-mindedly trying to understand by reading Prabhupada's books, what does Prabhupada want me to do? They'll come to the proper conclusion. But they come in with an agenda. I mean, they're like, one godbrother described, they're like attorneys, like lawyers, you know, trying to push forward an agenda, trying to twist the words to push forward their own agenda. That's what they're doing. They say that only Prabhupada can be a spiritual master. But Prabhupada, again and again and again, he said, the one who is now the disciple, he is the next spiritual master. It's right there in the Bhagavatam Purport. And he told one gentleman in Detroit, he said, in the future, they will be spiritual masters. My disciples will initiate disciples. He said, the sannyasis and also the householders, they will also do. So, you know, Prabhupada said it again and again and again and again and again, but they want to ignore all the evidence. He told us in Mayapur, he said that now we are 10,000, and then we will grow to 100,000, and then 1 million, and then 10 million. He said there will be no scarcity of acharyas. Prabhupada's vision was 10 million acharyas. These Vedic people say one acharya only. Prabhupada's vision, he told us directly, 10 million acharyas. So you're all meant to become acharyas. Everybody in this room is meant to become an acharya. And in some cases, according to time, place, and circumstance, means initiating acharya also, according to circumstances. You don't initiate when your guru is present. But after your guru is absent, he's left this world, if you are fixed in Vaishnava Siddhanta, then you also, you come empowered to initiate disciples yourself. So we want all of you to become acharyas. That is our mission. 10 million acharyas. And they say only one. They want to stop the sampradaya. It's crazy. It's been going on since time immemorial, and now they want to put a stop to it. That's not the Vaishnava system. They put a stop to the Guru Parampara system. That Prabhupada's the last one, there's no more gurus after him. They think Prabhupada is so impotent, he can't even make one person empowered to initiate disciples. Prabhupada, that would make Prabhupada the most impotent spiritual master in Vaishnava history. That's an apparatus against Prabhupada, to say that Prabhupada didn't have the potency to make even one disciple who could initiate anybody. That's a great offense. They're slapping Prabhupada in the face by such philosophy.
It becomes a paradox where they say that no one can become qualified to become guru. And if no one can be qualified to become guru, no one can be qualified to go back to Godhead.
That's right. Anybody who's qualified to go back to God is qualified to be a guru. And here's another one. Because according to Bhagavatam, no one should be a guru unless you can deliver your disciples. But in the same verse it says you shouldn't be a parent either. That means nobody can have kids either. We have to all be strictly celibate, you know, just brahmacharis. You know, no children allowed in ISKCON. If we take the Rithic philosophy to its logical conclusion, no one is allowed to have kids either, because no one's qualified to deliver their dependents. It's crazy. It's madness. Absolute craziness. And they're going on thinking that, you know, very proudly thinking that they're the leaders of Vaishnavism on the planet right now. I mean, it's crazy. Completely crazy. Yes?
What do you think of reading newspapers or watching the news to know what's going on in a particular city, to know the reach of people, or maybe watching certain movies to get examples for using in preaching?
It depends. It's a matter of degree. Prabhupada does mention in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya there is no prohibition against reading the ordinary news. He does mention them. So there is, devotees can be not, you know, for the sake of preaching, it's actually good to know what's happening in the world. But the thing is, if you get into it too much, then you lose your Krishna consciousness. So it has to be done very much, should be done in a very much, not that you come home every night and you got to sit down and watch, I don't know if they show CNN in here, but Now, they don't have that here, but not that you have to come home and watch the news on television. I recommend that very strongly, because then your children will want to watch TV. Don't watch TV. A little bit of news is good to know what's going on. But to sit down and every night have to watch, turn on the TV and watch the news, and then, well, the TV's on and now I'm plugged in, so there's another program coming. That's really bad. See? Now, I recommend strongly against watching television, because you get sucked into it and your kids. I went to one home where they were letting the children watch. They were nice devotees, chanting 16 rounds, but let the child watch the TV, the cartoons. And this child was so addicted to the television that I sat down on the couch. I simply sat down on the couch where he sat to watch television. He started crying because I was sitting on his TV spot. So it's better. I really recommend don't introduce TV into your home. If you love your children, don't watch. Don't have TV in your home. Let them learn how to, you know, cut vegetables when you're cooking. Let them also cut vegetables. You can give them a dull knife in the beginning. Let them participate in your bhakti activities. My philosophy is this. Why watch the news when you can be the news? You see? By preaching Krishna consciousness, you are a spiritual revolutionary. You're living on the cutting edge of world history. I mean, they should come in and cover you, what you're doing in your 24 hours, you know. Anybody who's actively pushing for this movement, they should be on the news every night. This is how many books that Rupa Raghunath Prabhu did today on George Street, you see. That should be in the news and in Sydney every night, you know. You see what I'm saying? This is what should be on the news. Why study history when you can make history? And that's my philosophy, you know. I mean, this mundane history, this mundane news is dry, it's dull, it's boring. What we are doing right here, right now, is more exciting than any of this junk they put on television. Why not just watch what's going on right here, right now? This is more exciting than anything you'll see on the stupid television set. The one-eyed guru, you know. TV is the one-eyed guru. Why not live an exciting life of Krishna bhakti and then, you know, let the news people come and cover you? Because you're doing something more exciting than they're putting on their stupid television program. You see? Yes?
One question. It's about, we maybe could clear this point out for me. It's about Red Book and comparing it to history of Christianity. So Christianity, you've got Anglican Church, you've got Roman Catholic, there's Russian Orthodox.
The Catholics have a living embodiment of, they still have their disciplic succession, the Pope. They consider him to be the, you know, divine personality who speaks on behalf of God. And they have their conception of Guru Parampara. Some instruction? Any other questions? Yeah.
We've been talking about the representative of Krishna.
The what of Krishna?
The representative.
Representative, okay.
And I've heard that, like, Krishna says, the one who loves me is not really my devotee, the one who loves my devotee.
That's right. What do you mean? You might feel that Krishna is your dear friend. Of course Krishna is your dear friend. Your question is
my
relationship with Krishna direct or indirect? That's what you're actually asking me.
I'm worried that maybe Krishna's thinking, well, if you really love me, you'd only be interested interested in what your Guru Maharaj does. He wouldn't just be just all the time calling out to me. He'd be, you know, more.
Well, here's the point. Let's see if this answers your query, if this satisfies you. Prabhupada explains in his purport in the Bhagavad Gita that the relationship with Krishna is simultaneously direct and indirect. As soon as we accept the principle of Guru, you see, that principle is required to get your direct connection with Krishna. If you try to come in, try to totally ignore the presence of Guru, have a relationship with Krishna, you'll never be able to connect with Krishna. But as soon as you accept the principle of Guru, then Krishna accepts you, that you can directly communicate with him. You understand my point? Here's a mundane example. I can talk to you like this, but we can also talk on a mobile phone. Now, when I talk on a mobile phone, am I talking to you directly or indirectly?
Directly.
Huh? Directly. But yet, it's indirect at the same time because, you know, the voice is creating a vibration which is interpreted electronically. It's transmitted through some radio waves, and then it's re-translated back into some audible vibration. So it's simultaneously direct and indirect. So Guru is like the mobile phone, you see. By the meeting of Guru, you're able to have that direct connection with Krishna, where you can call out Krishna and Krishna will accept you. In other words, you have the, just like to get on the internet, many wireless networks require a password to get on the wireless internet. You know, they're secured wireless sites. So the spiritual master is your password for getting on the wireless site. You see, your guru now, because you have a guru, now you have direct access with Krishna because of your guru's mercy. So yes, by the mercy of Guru, you can directly call out to Krishna and he'll accept your calls. You have your disciple of my disciple, all right? Then you can directly communicate with me because you have your password and you have your clearance, you see. But if someone says, no, I will not accept Guru, I just go directly to Krishna. He says, who are you? I don't know you, you see.
Yeah. Question, I guess a better way to add to my question, like my husband, he likes watching Prabhupada memories. Like if he's at home with the DVD, he'll watch stories about Prabhupada over and over and over, endlessly. Whereas I like it, but I have more of an interest. I like to watch like something like Govardhan Parikram or something. I'd rather hear Krishna's pastimes, even though I love Prabhupada's.
This is simply a matter of rasa, that's all. You don't love your spiritual master?
No, I do, but I just thought maybe that Krishna was thinking that...
Everyone has their own style, their own mood. This is not an impersonal movement. Everybody is a person here. That's the beauty of our movement. We have so many styles of personalities, and everyone, if somebody wants to watch Prabhupada movies and someone prefers to do Govardhan Parikrama, both are transcendental and wonderful. What's the difficulty? Prabhupada wanted to do Govardhan Parikrama also. What's the difficulty? I don't understand why there's a difficulty.
No, it's no difficulty. I just thought maybe that Krishna would prefer us, like Krishna would be thinking, well, the one who wants to hear about Prabhupada is really my devotee. The one who just wants to hear about me, they're not as dear to me.
It depends on the mood. The external activity is not the end all and be all. It's the mood in which you do it that really determines the difference. If you're in the mood of completely surrendering to Guru and Krishna, no matter what you do, whether it's Govardhan Parikrama or watching Prabhupada movies, you're properly situated. If your mood is being completely surrendered to Guru and Krishna, then you're properly situated no matter what you're doing in their service. Whether it's Govardhan Parikrama or Prabhupada movies, doesn't matter. It's the mood in which you do it that really counts. Understand? The external thing is not the issue, but the mood in which you're doing it.
Prabhupada's pastimes are part of Krishna's pastimes. We could consider like that.
That's certainly a fact. The pastimes, especially great devotees like Prabhupada, they're all part of Krishna's pastimes. That's a fact. So everyone is, actually it's Krishna's mercy is coming down through unlimited numbers of channels. Somehow connect with Krishna's mercy. That's all. Yes. Yeah, my godbrother Narantra Prabhu, he was there in Atlanta. He was doing traveling sankirtan. In those days, it was a big push that everybody should be distributing books. That's how you can really please Prabhupada the most. So he asked Prabhupada. He was a sankirtan party leader. Everyone knew what was his motive was. And he asked the question. He said, "Prabhupada, how can we please you the most?" There's 300 devotees, you know, sitting there. And everyone knew he's a sankirtan book distributor, party leader. He wants to get the endorsement that he's doing the best service than anybody else, you know. There was a hushed silence. How would Prabhupada answer this, you know? Especially for those who weren't book distributors, they're really wondering, well, what's Prabhupada going to say, you know? And Prabhupada said, if you love Krishna, that's what pleases him the most, you see. So really, that's the bottom line. I mean, you have try to learn how to love Krishna, whether you're watching Prabhupada movies or doing Govardhan Virakam or bathing in the Jamuna. Try to do it in such a way you develop your love for Krishna. That's how you'll please your spiritual master. That's how you'll please Prabhupada. That's how you'll please Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati. And ultimately, that's how you'll please Krishna. So just try to do everything in such a way to develop your love for Krishna. And just like here's a retreat now, and we are requesting everyone who has come here, try to participate in this retreat in such a way that you will develop your love for Krishna. Because that's the whole point of what we're doing here. It's the whole point of what we're doing. Develop love for Krishna. Our time, I think we're going 20 minutes over time. And we're capping into lunch. Is lunch ready? I should go on for how much longer? Five more minutes, okay. 5 or 10 minutes. Till 1:30 I'll go on then, okay. All right. Let's see if anybody else. I don't want to, all right.
We know that body is very important for carrying the soul to liberation or whatever next level it has to go.
Human body is very important, yeah.
So how much one should take care of the body? Like
enough to keep it functioning healthy. Keep it healthy. It's like how much you should eat. Eat as much as you can stay healthy. If you eat too little or too much, you'll become sickly. By overeating or undereating, in either case, he becomes sickly. Of course, overeating is more dangerous. But no, you should take the right amount, whatever you can, you eat enough to stay healthy. Take care of your whatever your body needs, just stay energized and healthy. That's all.
What exercises, like going to gym or stuff like this, is it?
Well, some exercise is good. Whether we need to go to the gym or not, actually, Prabhupada said the push-ups are very good exercise. He told one devotee, like, you know how the men do the push-ups? He said, those are good. So, of course, I was doing, but then I found out it was throwing my back out of alignment, so I stopped doing them. But that's another thing. But now, some exercise is good, but the thing is, why don't you sing and dance enthusiastically in the kirtan? That's very good exercise. One, if you had some time for exercise, why not go out on the street and distribute books? Or at least you can set up a book table if you're a little shy, you know. Invite the people over to your book table. The thing is, try to work, use your body in Krishna's service. That will, if you simply sit and don't do anything for Krishna, yeah, you'll need some exercise. Because you may have a desk job, you just sit all day at the office or something. But why not go to the temple and sing and dance enthusiastically in the kirtan? You get 20 minutes of aerobic exercise right there, you see. So, and then Prabhupada never had a program. Okay, now, my dear disciples, now it's time to go to the gym. He never was such a thing organized in ISKCON. We would get so much exercise by singing and dancing, you see. And then going out all day on the streets and approaching people with books. Working very hard. We'd be very tired at the end of the day and getting a lot of exercise, you see. And Prabhupada himself, he took a very brisk morning walk every day, you see, for good health. So, how much we really need to go and, you know, of course, if you're a kshatriya and you're on the battlefield, you know, you're not a kshatriya though. Okay. Then you need to have, you'd be very strong. You can kill somebody with your bare hands, you know. But I don't so much recommend that you spend your time. Are you chanting 16 rounds regularly? Mm-hmm. That's good. Are you rising early and having like Gurvastikam every day, and RT and Gurvastikam and all those things?
In the evening, but not the morning. I do in the evening.
So you're going to the gym every day? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't think the gym is so, a little exercise we can do even at home without having to go to the gym. You know, you can get some, a little exercise is good, I mean. But going into it so much, I have to get in the car and drive to the gym, spend an hour and a half every day so I can work out, it's just too much. You can do some little exercise at home, you know. Get one of these, you know, special exercise things, for home exercise things. Do a little exercise is good. But the main thing is we have to cultivate bhakti. We have to read these books. We have to help work with the devotees to create a wonderful Krishna consciousness movement, an ever-expanding Krishna consciousness movement. That's where we have to put our energies. Okay, we got 6 minutes left. By the mercy of Krishna you get Guru, and by the mercy of Guru you get Krishna. It's all connected. So what's the question?
I was just making that point that even though you may be just immersed in Krishna's pastimes, you're automatically immersed in Guru's pastimes because this is...
It's all connected. It's not that by becoming more conscious of Prabhupada you're becoming less Krishna conscious. You see? The more you think about Prabhupada, the more naturally you become Krishna conscious. The more you think about your Diksha Guru, the more naturally you become Krishna conscious. The more you think about Krishna, the more you think about your Guru. And there's no difference. They're all on the absolute platform. So the more you think about anything that's on the absolute platform, the more you become connected with everything on the absolute platform. Any other last questions, points? Yes?
Like, there will come a day when, like, let's say for example, when the whole world becomes Krishna conscious and everyone actually goes back to Golok Vrindavan,
mm-hmm.
What will happen to the world then?
This reminds me of Sarup Damodar Prabhu. He was a brahmachari. He was always playing the role of the scientist in these debates with Prabhupada on Venice Beach. Prabhupada was speaking very strongly about sex, how nasty it was. Prabhupada said, that is the position of the sex, that how nasty it is. But he playing the role of the scientist, he says, but Prabhupada, how to continue the species? And Prabhupada said, you finish it, this condemned world. So even if everybody went back to Godhead and this place became, you know, a desert island somewhere out in the universe, what's the harm? But actually it won't be. Because there are always living entities who are falling down from the spiritual world and coming here to make their attempt to be God, you see. It's always going to be happening. Of course, once they come and go back, they won't come again. Krishna guarantees, you know, once you go back, you won't come back again here. But there are many living entities who've never fallen down. Like, they haven't made this mistake that we did, and they in the future will make that mistake also. And they'll learn their lesson, and they'll go back, and they'll never repeat it again. So don't worry that if we all go back to Godhead, that Australia will become a desert island out in the Pacific somewhere. There'll always be living entities trying to, you know, misusing their independence. Remain what?
There are so many different species of living entities already here.
Yeah, even if all the human beings go back to Gaudiya, there'll be so many coming up from the lower species to become human beings. Every single living entity is a jiva, just like a human being is a jiva. The ant, the blade of grass, everything, living thing has a living jiva soul within it. So they're all gradually progress to the human form and get their opportunity to get out of the cycle.
And other species are greater in number than human beings. Other species are greater in number than human beings.
That's right. Even look at how many microbial germs there are in this room right now. Millions and billions of them. And they'll all eventually become human beings. So even if all human beings go back, there's no problem. You know, there'll be plenty of jivas taking human birth to get their opportunity to also get liberated. Somebody different had a question? Whatever he's been told, that will remain. It's said that he lives in Brajmandal. There's some rumor going on in Brajmandal. The people saw him, reported there was some person with very old skin. Ancient skin-looking skin was reported in Brajmandal. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's been reported that Ashwatthama is hiding out in Brajmandal right now. Okay, we got 2 minutes left. He hasn't asked as many as you have. Okay.
I'm just going to make that back onto the point about health, like these days people are quite more health conscious than like say when Iskcon started in the 70s, but like our diet, what we serve to people as a feast, tends to be, you know, nowhere near as healthy as what people have a conception of these days of being healthy. Like, so sometimes we get comments from people that come and you know they come and take this typical Hare Krishna feast and it's like, you know, it's totally unhealthy, it's all deep fried and white rice, white sugar, white flour. And so these days when people are more health conscious than those sort of people, they don't even come to the temple because we're not particularly giving them a healthy option, at least in some places.
So is that a question?
Yeah, like how should we change our diet, or should we just stick, you know, should we stick to the what we cooked in the 70s, or should we adapt the diet? Like, do we have to serve like, you know, deep fried puris, or can we serve essential to be Krishna conscious?
I know there's some pastime. The Prabhupada took some puri and put white sugar on it and ate the puri. It's according to time, place, and circumstance. For Krishna, we should always serve the deity should always get the type of prasad that Prabhupada had us serve the deity. That should never be changed. For time, place, and circumstance, you can make adjustments. But the deity should always get this prasadam.
Not the deity, what we should do, like Rida Nanamo, it says one class, like it says it's coming that all the intelligent devotees are the devotees that don't eat in the temple.
Well, Prabhupada, this whole issue was raised, there's a tape where you can hear where a devotee was asking Prabhupada. He said, Prabhupada, I don't want to eat at the temple because, you know, I just want to have fruits in the morning and the grains make me sleepy. Then Prabhupada said, the fruits are being offered to the deities. But then Prabhupada was encouraging all the devotees to eat in the temple. But then one householder said, well, Prabhupada, they're charging money and I can eat cheaper if I eat at home. He said, then it's all right. Prabhupada is very practical. Okay, so, but now we're all going to eat prasadam cooked here at the temple. And it's transcendental. Krishna prasad ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gantara Raja Vidya Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai.
Shankar Sen Maharaj ki jai.